car, so I step out in the AM. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation. Morning, fresh, oxygen, please. So I take a deep breath, help my mind stay the green. I'm already waking, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store, cause I need a few items. The sun heats my blood, like to hit a vitamins. I need about some food for my dread. I can't remember why, but I need a spool of thread. Well, a man with dirty dreads, he steps around the corner. He asked me for a dime, a nickel or a quarter. I don't have any change, so I'm stepping along. But as I'm walking past, he sings to me a song. These are holy.
Hello, you are listening to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. That song was Hole in the Bucket by Spearhead off their album Home. This is Hole in the Bucket, KBOO's show on poverty, housing, and homelessness. Hole in the Bucket is on 6 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday in rotation with Circle A and the Underground. Our mission on Hole in the Bucket is to incorporate the voices and ideas of people who have experienced poverty and homelessness and their allies into our show, making them authentic, informative, and entertaining. My name is Jamie Manuel, and I am co-hosting the show this evening with Joanne Zuhl. Today, our guests are Michael Anderson from the Affordable Housing Now campaign and Dan Newth from Southeast Uplift's Homelessness Working Group. We will be talking about affordable housing, outreach work on the issues of homelessness being done with the Neighborhood Association system, and why those are two great tastes that go great together. First, we're going to start off with some news items, and here's Joanne Zuhl and Kristen Crandall.
Good evening. It's crunch time for Dignity Village, Portland city-sanctioned homeless community. Today, the village of about 60 homeless people submitted a proposal to the city of Portland asking for a 10-year lease on its current site at Sunderland Yard. The proposal promises that in exchange for being permitted to stay at the current site, Dignity will provide several services to Portland's homeless and create a model ecologically sustainable and pedestrian-only community. Village Chairman Jack Tafari said the village has provided a transitional living situation for hundreds of people over the past 2 years, but Tafari added that the village is not trying to be an alternative to good permanent housing, rather an alternative to the streets. Under the terms of Dignity's proposal, the village would immediately start upgrading the facilities at Sunderland Yard, a point of contention for village critics. The village said it will address fire safety issues raised by members of Portland City Council. The village will then begin replacing the current makeshift structures with wood frame straw bale houses, including some multiple family housing. Tafari said that while the village is upgrading its facility at Sunderland Yard, it still plans to acquire a larger piece of property in the near future. All of the buildings the village will create will be movable. According to Tafari, Dignity's proposal also pledges to work better with other nonprofits that are trying to meet the needs of homeless people. Dignity Village has been at Sunderland Yard for 2 years.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development said this week it will make available $574 million in Hope 6 grants to revitalize aged public housing. For the first time since the inception of the revitalization program, HUD will award points to a public housing authority based on the number of units it has produced under previous Hope 6 revitalization grants. This move addresses the department's concerns that many past revitalization grant recipients have not produced units in a timely manner. HUD's Assistant Secretary said this year's grants seek to reward those housing authorities that are aggressively building housing. HUD has earmarked the majority of the money for revitalization and construction efforts to replace severely distressed public housing units. The rest will be used to remove dilapidated public housing units and develop support networks for administering the funding. Public housing authorities have until January 20th to compete for the revitalization grants. The deadline for the demolition grants is February 18th. Awards for the revitalization grants are generally made 4 to 5 months after the deadline. The maximum grant award for the revitalization program is $20 million. There have been 193 Hope 6 revitalization grants, a total of $5 billion awarded to 114 housing authorities since 1993.
Hundreds of students are preparing to converge on Hartford, Connecticut next week for the 16th annual Hunger and Homelessness Conference. The conference runs from October 31st to November 2nd at Hartford's Trinity College. The conference is the largest gathering of student leaders focused on hunger and homelessness issues in the country, according to event organizers with the National Student Campaign Against Hunger and Homelessness. More than 400 students, organizers, activists, and advocates are expected to attend. This year's conference will focus on mobilizing students and building a stronger country. Organizers hope students will learn valuable skills and ideas that will help them launch programs in their own communities. The conference will offer more than 60 workshops, panel discussions, issue briefings, networking opportunities, and speakers. The National Student Campaign Against Hunger and Homelessness was established in 1985 to bring together students around a common cause. The campaign works to sustain the largest national coalition of students and community members working to address the issues of hunger and homelessness through education, service, and action. Its work includes developing national programs, helping schools establish local projects, and training students to be more effective organizers and advocates. Since its inception, the campaign has raised more than $1.5 million for hunger and homelessness relief efforts.
The Oregon Food Bank Network distributed a record number of emergency food boxes to people who are hungry, with the number of people relying on emergency food increasing for the seventh straight year. The Oregon Food Bank Network's 338 pantries distributed emergency food boxes to an estimated 780,000 people in Oregon and Southwest Washington between July 1, 2002 and June 30, 2003. That's a 10% increase over the previous year. One regional coordinator in Douglas County said his organization has not had to deal with this much demand for emergency food since its first worst year in 1994. Others reported restricting the amount of food accessed by non-emergency programs. In addition, 148 soup kitchens and shelters provided 4.4 million emergency meals, and 346 other agencies helped more than 120,000 people at senior centers, daycare centers, and other low-income programs. Food Bank Director Rachel Bristol said the portion of food the bank receives from the Federal Surplus Commodities Program dropped significantly from 22% to 14%. Bristol said food industry partners, individuals, and corporations stepped up to fill the gap. Bristol also noted that Oregon and Clark County, Washington, continue to face an overwhelming hunger issue, even though an estimated 42% of households needing help have at least one working member. Rapidly rising costs and stagnant wages are considered a leading cause of hunger in the state. Some food bank distributors are expecting to see an increase in the number of families they serve in the coming months, when services are typically used most heavily.
Mentally ill offenders face mistreatment and neglect in many U.S. prisons, this according to the group Human Rights Watch, which released a report this week. According to the report, prisons are dangerous and damaging places for mentally ill people. Human Rights Watch says other prisoners victimize and exploit them, and prison staff often punish mentally ill offenders for symptoms of their illness, such as being noisy or refusing orders, or even self-mutilation and attempted suicide. The report states that one in six U.S. prisoners is mentally ill, with such conditions as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression. The report states that there are three times as many men and women with mental illness in U.S. prisons as in mental health hospitals. According to Human Rights Watch, the high rate of incarceration of mentally ill is a consequence of underfunded, disorganized, and fragmented community mental health services. The group claims that deficient mental health services in many prisons leave prisoners undertreated or not treated at all. The report is based on more than 2 years of research and hundreds of interviews with prisoners, corrections officials, mental health experts, and attorneys. The organization says that over the past two decades, mental health services in the United States have improved, but the rising number of mentally ill men and women entering the prison has outrun the availability of services. The organization is calling for support of proposed legislation that would improve federal grants to divert mentally ill offenders to treatment programs rather than jail or prison. The bill would also improve the quality of mental health services provided to jail and prison inmates.
A new homeless tent city has emerged in Portland and is now looking for a site. On October 16th, 17 currently homeless Portland residents camped in tents under the Morrison Bridge in an attempt to find support and stability through building community with others living on the streets. Members of the tent city, which goes by the name of Village Integrity, say they went to that location after Marshall Runkel, aide to City Commissioner Eric Sten, recommended they go hide under the bridge and then continue to move around. Ibrahim Mubarak, co-founder and spokesperson for the new village, claims its vision is to get a group of homeless people together that are tired of being pushed around to make a statement that if they're able to find stability and allowed the proper resources, then they can become productive in this society. Mubarak says the tent city is meant to be a place of transition where people on the streets are able to come get rest and find stability, under the assumption that once these needs are met, individuals are able to make clear decisions and create positive change in their lives. Members of the New Village insist that its emergence is not meant to rival the efforts of Dignity Village, Portland's original tent city, which Mubarak helped establish in Portland over 3 years ago, that it is part of the same movement. With a city-imposed limit of 60 members, Dignity Village is able to accommodate less than 5% of Portland's homeless population. Founders of the new Village Integrity voiced concern that the city mistakes its involvement with Dignity Village as adequately dealing with the more than 1,600 people living on Portland streets. Although Village Integrity was disbanded after only one day by the police, Mubarak says that as an alternate location is sought out, the number of homeless involved in the movement is growing steadily, and that the fight is far from being over.
Welcome back. This is Hole in the Bucket. We just had the news. That was Kristen Crandall and Joanne Zuhl. Thanks. We're here today with Michael Anderson from the Affordable Housing Now and Dan Newth, who's a representative of Southeast Uplift's Homelessness Working Group. And I introduced Dan that way earlier, and it's a little bit slight for Dan. Dan's also a contributing writer to Street Roots. He's involved with Crossroads, which is a people's organization founded by Sisters of the Road. He's doing a lot of work, and I believe, if I'm correct, and Dan can correct me on this if I'm not, he's also going to be on the Oversight Committee for Portland's 10-year plan to end homelessness.
That committee hasn't been selected yet. They're waiting on the chairperson for that committee to be selected before they're going to select individuals.
My apology. But Dan is probably one of the more politically influential people in Portland to not have housing right now. So let's start by having the both of you tell us a little bit about what you're doing. Michael, if you could go ahead and start, tell us a little bit about Affordable Housing Now, how it got started, and what work you're doing.
Sure. Let me start by saying it's always a privilege to be on the show. I really appreciate the work that you're doing in terms of giving a voice for people in a community that oftentimes is very much swept under the collective carpet in Portland. So my name is Michael Anderson. I work for the Community Development Network, which is a trade association of nonprofit housing developers. And my organization, along with the Community Alliance of Tenants, the Coalition for a Livable Future, and nearly 30 other groups ranging from the City Club of Portland to 1,000 Friends to Reach Community Development, have all joined together in a coalition called Affordable Housing Now. The goal of Affordable Housing Now is to get new funding for affordable housing for the Portland metro region. And to clarify that, when we talk about affordable housing, that's come to mean a wide range of things. If you talk to folks at the Portland Development Commission and look at the development we're going to see below Ross Island Bridge, that could be a condo that's worth $120,000 or more, or it could mean something that's affordable to people who, where you have two people in a family working at family wage jobs. There's a lot of expensive housing here in Portland right now. But Affordable Housing Now is concerned at people living below 30% median family income, which more or less are people who are living in poverty and do not really have an ability to compete in the private housing market.
Give us an idea of how much that is. 30% of median income, how much is that per year?
Well, let me give me a second, and I'll actually pull out a piece of paper that'll get to that exactly. I wish that I could just tell you off the top of my head. So why don't I tell you a couple other things about Affordable Housing Now, and then I'm going to come back and answer that question. So the other important priority that we have is that we believe that a solution to affordable housing has to be something that's region-wide. One of the things that we've seen is housing prices have far outstripped the wages that people can earn in Portland, is that poor people are getting pushed to the periphery of the city, that you can no longer afford to live in Portland. And I think that when we talk about how we're going to solve this, not only do we need to focus on the people most in need, but as well we need to focus on something that's going to deal with the way people have been displaced. So back to your question. For what I'm talking about when I say 30% median family income is for one person, this is making $12,000 a year, so $1,000 a month roughly. And for a four-person household, that's people who are somehow able to make it with $17,150 a year.
So we're talking a single person making minimum wage working full-time. about.
Yeah. Well, what it is, you know, if you work, for instance, say at a fast food place, it's very difficult to get even full time. So what this is a typical fast food workers often gets about three quarters time, and this would signify their wage. So we're definitely talking about people who are working. But that's at the top end of 30% MFI, median family income. We're also very concerned about people who aren't even making $12,000 in a year. You know, we're asking members of our society who are seniors, who are people with disabilities, to live on $517 a month less. I mean, it's what we're talking about is an extraordinary challenge to people, even if they did have housing. But most of these people at this point are being held in substandard housing positions at best.
Dan, can you tell us a little bit about the Southeast Uplift Homelessness Working Group and how you got involved with Affordable Housing Now?
Well, the Homelessness Working Group is a network of Dignity Village, Crossroads, Street Roots, five different neighborhood associations, and Southeast Uplift is the umbrella organization over the neighborhood associations and business associations in Southeast Portland. So it's not exactly just... Pardon?
Can you speak up a little bit?
Oh,
sorry. Just move a little bit closer to the mic.
Okay. The Houlton Homeless Working Group's a coalition of grassroots organizations advocating, well, from their perspective, and they're addressing homelessness as a concern and as it affects the society as a whole and the fabric of society. We try and bring a dialogue to different neighborhood associations and business associations to get them to speak their side and come up with potential solutions.
And so what's the relationship with Affordable Housing Now?
Well, the city is oftentimes in the past played the homeless advocates off the affordable housing advocates, saying, well, we can't build these shelters because we need to build affordable housing. And then we'll go to affordable housing and says, well, look at these people on the streets. We've got to put money towards the shelters, and so we can't afford to build affordable housing. So they've played one off the other in the past. And we feel we should come in coalition. It's not as easy to do that, hopefully.
I think the other thing that's really exciting about bringing together some of the efforts of Affordable Housing Now and the Homeless Working Group, as well as Crossroads and a lot of the other effort and momentum that's going on, is in the end we have the same goal. There's some different specifics. I think that the focus of the Homeless Working Group in terms of working with neighborhood associations, as Dan was saying, to get both viewpoints on the table or multiple viewpoints on the table is crucial. I think one of the things, it's not a coincidence that Dignity Village is called Dignity Village. I think the experience of people who are without homes is often being treated with a lack of humanity and respect that needs to be addressed, as well as the focus of Affordable Housing Now, saying we need real dollars to be put towards this situation so we go from the theoretical discussions of we have this need to money that can be used to make the differences that will change people's lives.
But Michael, I would imagine that it does your heart good to see a group like Southeast Uplift putting together this kind of a communal effort to address this, because I'm sure that one of the issues with affordable housing is getting over certain stereotypes or stigmas and into neighborhoods that will allow and support and promote and work to get affordable housing actually built.
Definitely. I think that one sad legacy that we work against is what affordable housing means to different people. You know, in my initial comments, I said affordable housing has been changed to mean stuff that is more expensive housing. But at the same time, affordable housing is often a cue word for racial stereotypes, class stereotypes, and there's a criminalization of poor people that is unfortunately underlies a lot of the way we think about words such as affordability. So I think to have people in the neighborhood associations rallying around Southeast Uplift to start looking at these issues is extremely hopeful.
And we covered earlier in the news broadcast, we had a story talking about how affordable housing is a key issue for the western states. I'm looking at a document from Northwest Pilot Project that talks about how in 1978, Portland had at 0 to 30% of median income around 5,500 units, and now we have around 3,500 units. So we've lost 2,000 units in the past 20-some-odd years, and that's at a time where the actual population of Portland's ballooned. So we're not just dealing with an actual lower number, but we're talking about greatly lower percentages. Why haven't we kept pace with affordable housing?
Is that a philosophical question?
I think that, you know, it really comes down to funding priorities. You know, now we can talk about, well, we're in this very difficult economy. What are we going to do? In the 90s, Portland and Oregon had a very robust economy, and there were opportunities during that time to find some solutions that we did not take advantage of. So really, in a lot of ways, it's a political will issue, in my opinion. I think that one of the things, and I know we'll talk about this in more depth, is that Portland, by and large, to supplement this city's own contribution, which I should say, relative to other cities around the country, Portland, its citizenry and its elected officials have done a good job prioritizing affordable housing. On the other hand, there has been a need and a search for exterior funding to meet the need. And in that search for funding, we've gone down the same road many different times, down to Salem to try to get a real estate transfer fee, a solution used in 35 other states, and we haven't been successful. So I should say it's two things. One, it was a lack of political prioritization to address this need, and then second, the road that we traveled, we were unsuccessful.
So is it a lack of prioritization that has, let the city focus on serving a certain degree of people under the median income of medium poverty range, but not the lowest? I mean, why can't, if they can put money to the people who fall within the 50 and 35%, aren't they, or 40%, whatever range they're putting the money on, because they are spending money on that, why don't they target the lowest level?
Actually, the 50 to 0% of median range, they mean that anybody who gets housing who makes less than half of what the median range is will pay one-third, if they're going through HAP or Section 8, they'll pay one-third of the rent for housing. So it's not that they don't focus on that. I think the root cause is none of the other elected officials have championed this cause. So the last time that any elected official in Portland did was Bud Clark back with the 12-point plan, and they made some good strides. You know, Central City Concern came out of that, Cheers came out of that, the Clark Center, Shelter for Homeless, came out of that. But the last 10, 15 years or so, that's kind of slid by the wayside. We've lacked the leadership in the city of Portland since then.
I think there's another element, too, that because as much as I agree, I think that we have failed to achieve the results in Portland. There has been a decent will and concern for dealing with this problem, but there's been various different factors that have played in as well. One is that it used to be that the federal government did far and away the most affordable housing development. During the Reagan era, that changed. And then in the 90s, at the same time, what we saw is these federal contracts that had kept housing at low income, many of which are the units that we're talking about that went away, those contracts expired. And you may remember we had the preservation housing ordinance work that was done. That was done to offset this change that was happening with this formerly federally funded building that had expired its length of necessary affordability, and private contractors were turning it around, and that, you know, thus the gentrification downtown that we've seen. So in fairness to our elected officials in Portland, there were some larger dynamics where there was used to be a major influx of money that moved away. But whereas, you know, the new priorities have been, I think, you know, that Dan raises a very good point, that, you know, a strident leadership that could achieve the money would be something that would be very welcome.
You mentioned before the real estate transfer fee, and this is something that's been supported by local politicians. Eric Sten's been a big champion of it. What's the barrier to that?
It's a combination of a few things. I think most particularly the realtors in this state are very well organized. They definitely have good lobbyists. But more than that, and I think this is where I draw some hope, is the realtors have networks among their fellow professionals and newsletters among their fellow professionals, such that whenever an election's coming up, a newsletter goes around with a slate of who you should vote for. In other words, in addition to having lobbyists, they have the organizational structure that they are a politically viable entity, so that elected officials fear taking on the realtors because they're afraid they'll wind up in that next newsletter as, like, you know, Joe Jones voted for the real estate transfer fee, we need to get him out of office. So I think that that's one piece. And then the other piece is that I think the real estate transfer fee, as it's played out, has often been something that would be a solution for Portland, but not for the rest of the state, in the way that it was framed by the people pushing the real estate transfer fee. And what comes out of that is that in Oregon, when you have a dichotomy that goes rural versus Portland, that's often a gridlock that's hard to break down. And so I think if we're going to overcome the real estate transfer fee, a big part of it is going to be engaging rural communities and helping them understand that the housing crisis that they're having, which are as real as Portland, this is going to blow folks away. But do you know the average home price in the city of Medford is $220,000 a year in Medford? And so the rest of the state is experiencing a housing crisis as well. So I'm confident with some organizing that we can change that Portland rural dynamic.
But there seems to be support in Portland for the real estate transfer fee. And the problem is that why does it matter what the rest of the state thinks?
Good question. Because the realtors in the late 80s, because they were concerned that Multnomah County would pass a real estate transfer fee, went down to Salem and put a preemption that made it illegal to have a transfer fee in any community around the state. And at this point, the only place in Oregon that does have a transfer fee is Washington County, which was able to have one grandfathered in because they passed a very minimal transfer fee that's used for their general fund, I believe, in the late 70s or early 80s.
So it's not a transfer fee that's going to affordable housing?
That's correct, except that Washington County, as a entity, gives a very small amount of money to affordable housing. So I guess you could say some of that general fund money fuels into it, but certainly it's not earmarked.
Thank you.
So we're definitely talking about an organization effort that has to go beyond neighborhood associations because it's not just a Portland-wide issue. It has to become a state issue to get this repealed.
I would say yes and no. We have a mayoral election coming up, and I know that the mayoral candidate who has been in front so far, Commissioner Jim Francisconi, recently addressed a group of realtors and said that he's opposing the real estate transfer fee. So I think that it's interesting as we try to figure out, you know, what we're going to do in this next mayoral campaign, that we find a candidate who's going to support this tool if and when we can get the rest of that organizational infrastructure statewide.
Is this a new position for Francisconi? Do you know?
I think that depending on different audiences and venues, you know, this position has shifted, and it could shift again. I mean, I think that the commissioner was addressing a group of realtors, and I'm sure it was a tough question that he faced.
Can you outline then for someone who's going to buy a $100,000 home how the transfer fee would work and what kind of charge they would be looking at?
If they were going to buy a $100,000 home, in all likelihood with the
if they could find a $100,000 yeah. home, I guess I should start with that.
Yeah, well, why don't we say that they're going to buy a $150,000 home? And the answer would be that I don't have the math in front of me, but the answer would be that that house would be exempt from the transfer fee. In other words, because $150,000, although that's a ton of money, is still an affordable home purchase in Portland, it would be exempt. In other words, houses below 80% of the median family home price would not have to pay. So some of the scenarios that we've heard among concerns of realtors is, well, what if I have a client who is a single widowed grandmother who needs to sell her house to have some retirement money, and her house is only worth $150,000. Would she have to pay this fee? No, she wouldn't. But let's say grandma lives out in the hills in Beaverton and owns a $270,000 house. Yes, she would have to pay. It would be somewhere in the range of 0.5 to 0.75%. So we're talking about somewhere in the range of 1,000.
Yeah, I think 0.5% of 200,000 would be around $1,000.
So, you know, $1,200, $1,300.
This is what the seller pays, not the buyer.
The seller. Now, yes, the cost would be assessed to the seller. Realistically, what people in the market say is, well, that's going to jack the home price
up.
Sure.
It's just included in the price, absolutely.
Okay, I think we're going to take a music break, and then we'll be right back. This is Hole in the Bucket. That was Bottleneck Blues by Warren and Beasley. I'm here today with our guest, Michael Anderson, with Community Development Network, part of the Affordable... You're with the Community Development Network as part of the Affordable Housing Now Coalition?
Yes, correct.
Right. And Dan Newth, who's here with Southeast Uplift's Homelessness Working Group. We're talking about affordable housing, and what I'd like to get back to is there was a bill that was in front of the state Congress this year that was going to allow for the possibility of real estate transfer tax for affordable housing. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened with that?
Yeah. Much like we've seen for the last seven sessions, There was a bill introduced to overturn this preemption that means that it's illegal to have a transfer fee in any community in Oregon. But that bill was unable to get too far because of the stiff opposition. There was a hearing in committee in Senate, although it wasn't a public hearing. And basically, I think it's fair to say that although there was support of the Democrats in Salem, both in the Senate and the House, the fact that they are a minority and the fact that there were many irons in the fire meant that folks felt that the transfer fee was too big of a hill to climb. And although there was many wonderful people in Salem in support of it, in terms of pushing it, I guess the feeling was the momentum was not there this session to make a difference. I should say, with that bad news that happened in the Capitol, there was some great news that happened around the Capitol, which is that working in coalition with groups like the Oregon Food Bank, like the State Disabilities Commission, beginning to have conversations with people who work on the various schools coalitions, we've begun to branch out and build a network that goes beyond the usual suspects, both in terms of geography, people who live in rural areas. There was excellent work done by Oregon Action's Jackson County chapter in the Medford area and Ashland area. You know, I mentioned the outrageous housing prices there. There's been a lot of local organizing saying we need a transfer fee to fund affordable housing. That is something that's new. And then as well with these other groups with statewide constituency, I just came from a meeting today of about 30 people from around the state developing messaging work similar to the food bank to raise the profile of affordable housing in a more effective way. In other words, we know that we have an issue that is right. We just don't know how to convey that message in such a way that the people of Oregon understand that this is in their best interest, both socially and financially, to meet these affordable housing needs, and the real estate transfer fee is the way to get us there.
So this is an issue, and I've seen this a number of times. Politicians often like to play lip service to this issue. They will say that they're for affordable housing. In 2001, there was a big public hearing with Dignity Village, and Jim Francesconi said to the village that really you don't want a camp, you don't want a tent city. What you want is affordable housing. Though you just told us a little while earlier that he got in front of a real estate organization and said he won't support the real estate transfer fee in order to get that affordable housing. We're often told, really, you know, these criminalization issues, anti-camping ban, all of that, we're not going to address these directly. You want to deal with the real root issue, which is affordable housing and jobs. I have a letter here from actually the Commissioner Leonard to myself that came from when an organization I was working for was dealing with the sit-lie issue, and it says basically the same thing. We're not going to deal with sit-lie. We're not going to deal with Oregon Department of Transportation sweeps of people camping on those lands. The real issue is affordable housing. How do you as an affordable housing advocate kind of – what's your take on that?
Well, I think that I think that people who are homeless and that people who are low income are people who are easily ignored by the elected officials, most simply because they're not people who occupy the halls of power. And I think that the issues of being homeless and being without something so basic as a stable living environment is something that, by and large, is theoretical to people who are able to be elected into office. Now, that, you know, I know that different of our elected officials come from different economic backgrounds, and not to say that they weren't in very challenging economic backgrounds. But rather, I think it's very interesting around the sit-lie and around Dignity Village that there's this concept of, well, you need to wait till we fix this problem of affordable housing because that's what you're really upset about, and when we get to it, everything will be fine. You know, how do you wait on an evening like tonight when it's pouring, not to mention on a night when it's nice, but the police could roust you at any moment? So I think that I think for an elected official, it's a sticky issue because you're on record. I mean, look, we're talking about different stuff that they said right now on the public airways. But that being said, I think that the failure to take seriously the direness of what it means to be homeless and what it means to be without a place is part of the reason why SITLI is still in place, part of the reason why people say, well, we need to do better than Dignity Village. Sure, we need to do better, but in the meantime, why don't we go with something that is working?
Well, because we don't have the money for affordable housing now, when Eric Stem was at the Affordable Housing Now meeting in September, he made a comment, we want to have enough affordable housing for everyone in this city in our lifetimes. Well, I think Eric's in his early 30s or late 20s.
It could be a while.
So that may not be in my lifetime, especially seeing that I'm living on the street, you know, and I'm going to have to sleep in a wet sleeping bag tonight. But situations like Dignity Village, where they at least have a relatively safe place to sleep relative to being out on the street and being rousted by the police to have to move to some other place where they're going to have to deal with people they don't know and situations they're uncomfortable with. Dignity Village is far and beyond much better than that. And for the elected officials to refuse to acknowledge that is inhumane. And in fact, Randy Leonard has now acknowledged that Dignity Village is better than being on the street. I'm not sure what Commissioner Francesconi's position is on that, but Commissioner Francesconi did say that the city council at this point is willing to support Dignity Village when they come up with their proposal and they will review it. And that at least that much is positive. So at least that 60 or 80 people have a more stable place than living on the street dealing with the rain tonight. Of course, it may be coming through their tents and their tarps that they have out there, too. I'm not sure.
Well, speaking on this topic, the two of you will be meeting with our city commissioners soon, correct? And what will those conversations look like?
Well, I think that Affordable Housing Now, since the beginning of August, has been doing a postcard campaign with City Hall with a very basic message saying, we need new funding for affordable housing in 2004. We can do better. And through that process, we know that the mayor's office has already received over 700 postcards, and we have another 350 to deliver to her when she agrees to meet with us. And then the other city commissioners have a lesser amount than the mayor, but still in a very sizable range. There's been a very good response. What those conversations will be is to talk to them about how that funding's going to happen, not just in 2004, but over the long term. The mayor and Eric Sten, in addition to the Commission on Homelessness, have another commission that they formed, a Blue Ribbon Commission on New Resources for Affordable Housing. And this commission involves people in power, be it elected office or be it in business or other community leaders, not just in Portland, not just in the Portland metro region, but really they've begun to reach people across the state, people from the governor's office, people from the state housing office. So it's an exciting group they're bringing together. And I think quite possibly with the efforts that are happening in rural Oregon, that 3-4 years down the line, we could have, be it a real estate transfer fee or some other source, a permanent source of funding to help meet the affordable housing need. In the meantime, we still need other funding. And Eric, Commissioner Sten, has said that he is going to approach his fellow city council members in the spring in the budget hearings and talk about a general fund allocation to meet this gap. And we're very excited to get behind him and support that. We're also, when we meet with the city commissioners, going to ask them what would their solutions be. I should say, in fairness to Commissioner Francesconi, his opposition to the real estate transfer fee does not mean that there aren't other strategies that he isn't interested in. He's been more interested in the bond strategy or a levy strategy as a way of funding affordable housing. But again, that's still 3-4 years away.
Hasn't he also talked about increment tax financing a bit? There's been some talk about tax increment financing, although that gets to be a pretty sticky wicket for politicians quickly. And at least in my experience so far, talk about doing something with tax increment financing happens more behind closed doors than it does in a public setting.
So how much money are we talking about possibly coming from the general fund?
That's a good question.
And how much housing would it build?
That's another very good question. In the mid-90s, Portland was able to generate $30 million over a five-year period for in something called the Housing Investment Fund. And that fund was used for a wide array of things, preserving some of the housing that was turned over that I was talking about earlier from the expiring HUD contracts. It was used to help fund programs like Transitions to Housing, which had been so successful in helping people move from the streets or marginal housing situations into more permanent housing. And it was also used in projects that built housing across a lot of income levels. Hitting people who are below 60% median family income or 50% median family income, as well as, you know, people at the low income. In terms of the total units produced by that, where it gets difficult is, and I should say this is where it gives the wiggle room, if you will, to public officials when they're talking about affordable housing, is the money that the city put in there was then blended with federal money, state money, private money to put together a package, Portland Development Commission money, to put together a package that built a large number of housing units. But to say which went was from the Housing Investment Fund is difficult. It's more like when the city can give money from the general fund, that money, by and large, is free and clear from various programmatic restrictions that you get with federal monies, such that it feeds the pipeline and opens up and allows for more construction. So my short answer would be, I can't tell you the amount of units that it produced. In the hundreds, for sure.
In the hundreds.
Didn't we have a net loss during that period of time of affordable housing?
That's correct, and that's why it gets complicated, because we did have a net loss of affordable housing, but that wasn't because the Housing Investment Fund was inadequate. In fact, that was a new chunk of money that the city of Portland found. But the other sources of money that were going on, and most importantly, the timing of the turnover, before there was the Preservation Housing Ordinance, when those contracts expired, the housing could just turn over. The city didn't even get a shot to buy it. So, you know, there was a lot of bleeding during that period. And, you know, we've had a lot of gentrification in the city as well.
So we're heading towards the end of the hour. Dan, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the work that the Homelessness Working Group out of Southeast Uplift is doing. You're meeting with neighborhood associations, and I believe the idea is just to start a dialogue with people.
We have them read cards that have comments that go from both extremes of the scale, you know. And that's to set a stage where they feel comfortable expressing their own opinion freely. And first we'll talk about the problems they see about homelessness, and that gets them engaged. And then we ask them for what they see as solutions. This gives the people an opportunity to buy in, to get interest, to express themselves. And we've come up with quite a few good ideas, none of which I have in the top of my tip of my tongue right now. Sorry.
But you're going out, you're talking to neighborhood association people, and you're getting their ideas of how to solve homelessness in their neighborhood?
Right, and we're hoping to incorporate that with the city's 10-year plan to end the institution of homelessness. Also, we're trying to build political will, interest in the subject, awareness of the subject. Corporate media just doesn't give us a fair break. They're not well informed.
You know, I really briefly had this experience the other day watching the news, and it was the first half hour of the news was all crime stories, and I realized that probably, you know, that much crime had happened in that day, but you probably could have just as easily filled all that time with stories of people getting evicted because their unemployment check ran out and they didn't have affordable housing, and how much different our priorities would be if that was what the news was like. Just to resonating with your point there. So with this group, how can people get involved with that work?
Monday nights at Southeast Uplift, that's 3435 Southeast Main, three blocks north of Hawthorne, at 4 o'clock, the second and fourth Monday of the month. And you can just show up.
And you're having volunteer orientations, correct?
3534 Southeast Main. We're going to schedule volunteer orientations. Oh, we do have? We have volunteer orientation scheduled for Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m., Thursday, December 4th from 2 to 5 p.m., and Wednesday, January 14th from 9 a.m. to 12 noon.
And so anybody can feel free to come to those if they want to get involved with the work that you're doing.
We would really appreciate it.
And, Michael, how can people get involved with affordable housing now?
They can call me at 503-335-9884. Or they can go to the Community Development Network webpage, CDN Portland, that's www.cdnportland.org. And we have a number of different committees that you can get involved with, our Research and Policy Committee, our Outreach Committee. We have a Speakers Bureau that actually, this coming Monday, our Speakers Bureau will be doing a presentation to the Homeless Working Group. After a month ago, we had the Homeless Working Group do a presentation with us, sort of as an exchange of ideas.
And so that would be a time you could come down to Southeast Uplift and get involved with both?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, one thing I'd like to say is I feel that both Dan and I at times have, with some of these questions, sort of been stumbling for words. And, you know, by no means is this a simple issue, but I guess to me, what it comes down to is whatever the complexities are of figuring out how we're going to build this housing and how we're going to make this housing affordable, that the price we pay for not doing it and the complexities that unfold when people have to live on the streets or families are being broken apart or people with debilitating conditions are put in situations where, you know, we had heard that report about the effect of prisons on people with mental illness. The costs that we pay for that so far outstrip what we're doing now that whatever the road we have to go down, we must go down it.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, both of you, for coming in tonight. Certainly appreciate it, very enlightening. I would add that community development website is very thorough for anyone who wants to just find out more information about the figures and the numbers on affordable housing here in Portland.
Well, this has been a hole in the bucket. Thank you both for coming in. Our guests today have been Michael Anderson and Dan Newth. And I'd like to thank our engineer, Liam Delta, and my co-host, Joanne Zuhl, and Kristen Crandall for helping to produce the news this evening. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. Next up will be DJ Audio with Nonstop Hip Hop and the Community Calendar.